It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Sunday, February 20th, 2022. I'm Jared Halpern. Is diplomacy still an option to end the Russia-Ukraine crisis?
We're sort of in a loop, and we don't know at what point somebody spins off that loop.
And House leaders take a rare step, endorsing the primary rival of a fellow Republican.
Liz Cheney is in a very tough re-election. Her odds are slimmer by the day in a Republican state like Wyoming.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. There's been a lot of air travel between Moscow and other European capitals, shuttle diplomacy, with a growing number of Russian troops, more than 150,000, NATO and the USA, surrounding Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has met with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and French President Emmanuel Macron. There have, of course, been phone calls with President Biden. An invasion, President Biden and European leaders insist, would trigger unprecedented sanctions and a strong NATO presence in Eastern Europe. Fox News correspondent Amy Kellogg has covered Moscow and the Russian president for decades. She shared her reporting from the Russian capital as the threat of war looms.
The line here, and it's pretty widely accepted and bought, if you will, is that the Russian speakers or ethnic Russians in Ukraine are under grave threat, that this Kiev regime, the Volodymyr Zelensky regime, is fomenting nationalist sentiment and is discriminatory towards non-Ukrainians, which I personally have not seen evidence of. I don't live in Ukraine, but that is the line. And Putin has always put himself forward as the protector of Russians. So, I mean, see, if you want to be cynical and or critical, you would say that he's trying to create a pretext to go in there to protect, quote unquote, his people. He dismisses the fact that he wants to take any part of Ukraine or to control Ukraine, but he or his people will say that it's what he has said, of course, that it's unacceptable that that Ukraine would become part of NATO because it would be just too much of a security threat for Russia. So, you know, on the one hand, he's been clear that he's concerned about Ukraine joining NATO. And he also, and many official Russians will say that the US and the West are pushing Ukraine to be very pro-West and very anti-Russian. And then he will say, and yeah, and because of all of this, Russian speakers are under threat. So that could be the pretext ultimately for something really violent to kick off. And it may be happening even as we speak. We're hearing reports of a big explosion in Donetsk, which is one of the self-declared republics under the control of Russian-backed separatists. So that is kind of the landscape right now.
Right. And so I guess before all of that was a lot of shuttle diplomacy. We've seen a number of European leaders meet with President Putin. What have those discussions been like? Are they at the invitation of the Kremlin? And is that diplomatic path making any headway?
It's really hard to know, Jared, because yesterday we had a response from Russia to Secretary of State Antony Blinken's written responses to the Russian requests. So, and the language was very, I would say, aggressive on the Russian responses, but it's been pretty much formulaic where Russia says we can't have Ukraine in NATO. We can't have NATO expand anymore. We don't want any Western weapons in Ukraine, and we don't want any strategic weapons in Eastern European countries that used to be part of the Warsaw Pact. And those are non-starters for NATO and for the US. So Russia keeps saying that their needs are not being met, but that they are willing to talk about other security related issues for Europe and Russia particularly. And that would be arms control and some more transparency on these military exercises. So Russia says that it will be open to those discussions, but it also always adds that this won't go forward unless its key demands are met. So we're sort of in a loop, and we don't know at what point somebody spins off that loop.
When you talk about...
It's unclear how it could be resolved if there are these two separate sort of ultimatums.
When you talk about arms control, is that sort of an agreement that NATO won't deploy missiles and stuff in, the eastern flank? Is that one of the main concerns here? These military exercises?
Yeah, they don't want nuclear weapons on their eastern flank or their western flank, Russia's western flank, mm-hmm. and the INF treaty, which regulated the numbers of, I guess, intermediate range nuclear weapons that each side could have, I guess just, it no longer functions. So I think it would be returning to that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like these exercises that Russia says that it has the right to be conducting all around Ukraine on its territory. I think if there had been a very credible explanation as to why this needed to happen, we'd be in a different place. But I think therein lies the contradiction at the moment, where there really is no reason for such military exercises to be happening right now.
Let's talk about what's happening here in the United States. Obviously, President Biden has said that if there is an invasion of any kind, it will be met with strong financial economic sanctions. Lawmakers have said the same thing. Are those threats of sanctions, the reality of sanctions, a real disincentive for the government in Moscow?
They won't admit it, Jared, but I can't imagine how they wouldn't be. When I first started coming to Russia for Fox 20 years ago, it was 30 rubles to the dollar. Now it's in the 80s. So obviously there are a lot of different reasons for that, but certainly economic isolation is not going to help that. They put on a brave face saying that we really need to be independent and have our own industry and our own alliances outside of Europe, apart from the United States. We need to trade with China. We need other partners. But I think particularly if they were cut off from SWIFT, and I don't really understand fully how that all works, but that mm-hmm. would be horrific for them. And I think they hold out hope that people would still need to buy their oil and gas. They somehow think that's going to keep working or that's going to keep happening even in the event of something bad, because Europe particularly needs them. And I don't know to what extent that is true, but they say they're not scared, but I can't believe that they would be, they would really handle it well. And I don't know to what extent it's a deterrent, because they simply won't admit anything.
What is the economy like in Russia right now?
Well, it's people project that GDP growth has been clipped by about 3% a year because of sanctions. So that's a lot. And there is this line about corruption here being a very serious issue, and that hurts an economy. The cost of living is very high, but I think that's not exclusive to Russia right now. Inflation is a problem everywhere. It's interesting. Moscow is a microcosm. Moscow is a highly functional city. It's very efficient, and a lot of things work very well here. But I think when you go out into the regions, it's a different story. And I think for people who don't have a solid income, it would be very difficult to live in Moscow, because it is not a cheap city. I don't have figures for unemployment mm-hmm. to hand, but people are complaining that the economy is not in a great place. You hear that a lot. Obviously, they're dealing with things like we are, COVID closures. I've seen a lot of empty storefronts. But again, that is also somewhat universal now. I do think there's a sense that Russia has shot itself in the foot over the years, especially when the price of oil was as high as it was at once, by not developing industries outside of petrochemicals.
What's the popularity of President Putin?
I spoke to a pollster yesterday, and it's in the high 60s. That's the approval rating. And it was around 80 after Russia annexed Crimea. That is called the Crimean Consensus. Putin's popularity shot up in the aftermath of the annexation of Crimea. Now it's in this high 60s, which is something that American presidents would dream about. But obviously, it's a different situation here. And the pollster did say to me, and this is a pollster who's quite credible here. It's, you know, I think the ability to do completely honest polling here is not does not exist. But this is a pretty, as far as the pollsters go, this one is believed to be the most independent. And he said that part of the popularity is based on the fact, a large part is based on the fact that Russians don't believe there's anyone else who could do the job or would be allowed in to do the job. So Putin is really the only person Russians know. And like him or not, he's got a certain track record. And so, yeah, part of it is that there's probably some respect for the fact that he's a strong man, but there's also a sense that there's no one else.
Mm-hmm. I'll finish with this, Amy, because you've lived in Russia now or at least covered Russia for a long time now. What do Americans need to understand about this conflict between Russia and Ukraine that maybe we just don't understand?
I think the sense I get from Russians is that they do not want to control Ukraine. They don't want to own Ukraine. They feel very close to Ukrainians. And it's mm-hmm. tragic for a lot of them. Well, first of all, because there are a lot of families that are mixed, but also because they have this brotherly historic relationship, and that is really being strained by this. I think that the propaganda, if you want to call it that, here works very well, because this pollster was saying that a lot of Russians believe that it's the U.S. the U.S. and the West that's forcing Russia into this situation, has wedged it into between a rock and a hard place by the NATO expansion. And there's a sense that that America had an arrogant attitude after the Cold War, that we won and we weren't going to do anything to help Russia get on its feet. And that resonates here. I mean, whether that's right or wrong, it's something that you need to be sensitive to, because that's how a lot of people here actually feel. Certainly we can say objectively that Russia has done a lot to harm its own interests. But I think it's important to understand how they feel and what they're thinking when you deal with them. And I think for the average Russian, it's been hard. The person who's not political, who's just trying to live his or her life, that their reputation in the world has taken a hit from all of this. And I think that's tough.
Amy Kellogg, our reporter in Russia, watching all of these developments, valuable insight. I really appreciate your time at a very busy time for you. We'll stay in touch. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jared.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Here's something that doesn't happen very much. A congressional leader endorsing against a sitting member of Congress of his or her own party. But it happened this week. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy officially threw his support behind Harriet Hegeman. Hegeman is running against Congresswoman Liz Cheney in Wyoming's Republican primary. The number 3 House Republican, Elise Stefanik, also publicly endorsed Hegeman. Stefanik was elected to that post after House Republicans ousted Cheney from House leadership last year. Cheney has been a frequent target of former President Trump's anger, and Cheney's criticism of Trump and inclusion on the House committee investigating the January 6th riot have put her out of step with many of her House GOP colleagues. And the primary could become another test case of the power of the former president in Republican races. Fox News Radio political analyst and National Journal columnist Josh Krossauer looks at that dynamic of the midterms.
It's very unusual, and it goes against the National Republican Congressional Committee's stated policy of endorsing incumbents. That's generally a rule that they abide by. Usually the party committee, party leaders don't get involved at all in primaries, but if they do, it's on behalf of a member of Congress, not against the primary challenger.
So what's behind this? I mean, obviously, McCarthy has been critical of, as have the rest of House Republican leadership, critical of Cheney. They took the step of removing her from party leadership last year. But at the same time, McCarthy has resisted calls from particularly the conservative wing of his party to expel her from House Republican membership. Is this kind of a middle ground? What's behind this endorsement?
Well, look, I think a lot of it has to do with politics. Liz Cheney is in a very tough reelection. Her odds are slimmer by the day in a Republican state like Wyoming, and she now has really one serious challenger in an attorney, Harriet Hageman. So, McCarthy wouldn't be doing this if Cheney had a decent shot of winning. I think the expectation now is that, you know, she may end up losing pretty significantly to this more conservative primary challenger. I shouldn't say more conservative, but more pro-Trump primary challenger. But look, it still is very unprecedented and speaks to McCarthy's need to ingratiate himself with the right-wing elements of his own caucus. He's looking ahead to the leadership races of beyond 2022, beyond this year's midterm elections, and he knows that he needs every Republican vote he can get. And if there's some frustration that people on the right think he's too close to Cheney, or he's not pro-Trump enough, which is hard to believe, but that's the rap on the right against McCarthy, then he could get into trouble within his own party. So he's trying to protect his right flank by making this endorsement, looking at the context of his own leadership fights and also the politics of Wyoming.
Let's talk about the race a little bit, because there are a few things that are interesting. One is that Hageman, as you point out, seems to be moving into sort of that front runner role, but it at least right now remains a fairly crowded Republican primary. And there is not a runoff system in Wyoming, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the best bet for Liz Cheney is that, number one, there would have been a lot of Republican candidates splitting up the anti-Cheney vote, and that maybe some Democrats and independents end up. Right now, as of today, state law allows Democrats and independents to vote in a Republican primary. So maybe she peels off some folks that are not as partisan.
We'll talk about that in a second. Finish your thought, but I want to talk about that too, because that made some news this week.
Yeah, and that was part of the initial thinking that a crowded field of challengers could actually benefit Cheney quite a bit. But I think the bigger problem for Cheney, though, is that, number one, that hasn't really transpired, and number two, Hageman has consolidated support among the more Trump conservative elements of the Republican Party in Wyoming. So there was a time when there were many candidates looking at running against Cheney. Hageman, there are still Anthony Bouchard. There are a few other candidates on that ballot, but Hageman has definitely consolidated the anti-Cheney sentiment in the Republican Party there.
Well, and listen, having these endorsements now from McCarthy and Elise Stefanik certainly is going to open up a ton of fundraising, you would think, right? I mean, are these endorsements now tied to financial support?
Well, fundraising is interesting because Liz Cheney has been one of the best fundraisers,
right?
For national.
She raises a lot. I mean, listen, she's a Cheney.
She is a Cheney. She's raised more money than she ever has, though. And that's part of the dynamic of our politics, that money may not matter as much. I mean, it matters to raise money, but ultimately the bigger test is where voters are, not who's giving money to the various candidates. And Hageman, she just filed her end of quarter, report, and she's done quite well on her own on the fundraising front. She raised almost $500,000 in the last quarter, which is pretty good for a House candidate. So even though Cheney raised a lot more money, Hageman is certainly bringing in enough dollars to run a serious race.
I will say Wyoming's media markets are not as expensive as other media markets.
Cheyenne, yeah, it's a small state.
Smaller state, yeah.
It's a big state, small population. But
right, and the media markets are smaller. There's sort of you don't have to spend quite as much as you would in big urban areas generally.
That's right. I mean, and you see this with a lot of very extreme candidates who raise a lot of money on the left and on the right, but they don't need all. I mean, you don't need a certain amount to run a serious race. And Hageman looks like she's hit that mark to raise enough money to run a good campaign.
So let me talk about the way that the primary is set up. This is not you know, some states do this, open primaries. Texas, for instance, is a big state that does the open primary system. You get the vote in a primary, the Republican or Democrat primary. You only vote in one, and you don't have to be pre-registered with a party to vote, right? So that would allow independents, people without a party affiliation, Democrats to vote in a Republican primary in Wyoming, right?
Yeah, that's right. Every state has their own rules for primaries. Virginia, where I'm from, you could be a Republican and vote in a Democratic primary. Yeah. You can't vote in both, but you can
pick
one.
You vote in one or the other. And they're generally called open primaries.
Primaries.
As opposed to closed primaries, which require you to, at a certain deadline before the election, register with one party or the other.
That's right. And Wyoming is one of those states with an open primary. Democrats, independents can vote in the Republican primary. Now, right now, that's the law in place.
Former President Trump endorsed a proposal this week that I guess is in the state legislature that would change that, right?
That's right. That Trump, Donald Trump Jr., is lobbying for a change in the law to close the primary to just Republican Party voters to help boost Hageman's chances, to help hurt Cheney's chances.
So this is about that rate. This is about Cheney. The idea is Cheney may not have as much support as she once had with Republican voters in Wyoming, but she could survive if, say, Democrats, knowing that there's really not a viable alternative, or independents vote for her.
Yeah, Trump is obsessed with defeating, by any means possible, any of his opponents, any of his rivals, any of his critics. Earlier last year, he tried to change the rules to allow for a runoff system in Wyoming, which ended up not getting through the state legislature. I don't know what the status of this legislation is,
but the
degree of aggressiveness and obsessiveness that Trump is paying to local Wyoming politics just to oust Liz Cheney speaks to just how, you know, single-minded he is in trying to purge the party of any of his critics.
So a couple more questions then. If Cheney survives this, and I know right now that looks increasingly unlikely with the way that polling is showing, and these big endorsements are certainly notable as well, where would she fit in under a Kevin McCarthy speakership?
Very uncomfortably, right? I mean, the relationship between the two has been awkward from ever since she decided to work with Democrats on the January 6th commission. And
I mean, it really started to bristle even before then.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, because she had been very outspoken against the former president, you know, after the election.
There was a moment, I can't remember exactly when it was, when McCarthy was asked about Trump and he dodged the question, and Cheney
and
at the same briefing
forward,
was asked
and
said, I want nothing to do with this man. And it was an extremely awkward moment with all the House Republican leaders standing next to each other. So, yeah, you're right, Jared. This was a little bit before the commission, but tension, you know, initially McCarthy defended Cheney and didn't, you know, want to kick her out of leadership, didn't want to, you know, censure her as some of the right wing members of his party advocated for. But as she ended up getting, you know, becoming more of a thorn in Trump's side, and certainly when she joined along with Adam Kinzinger, the January 6th commission investigating what happened on January 6th, that was sort of the beginning of the end. And her own state party, I believe, expelled her, or, you know, basically kicked her out of the party, censured her.
We saw what happened at the RNC. Yeah.
RNC did the same thing. I mean, the writing was on the wall. Right. The only question was how far was McCarthy himself going to go?
So does this take the pressure then? I mean, you don't expect the House Republicans to move on her, to expel her, you know, before November at this point, do you? Or is that still sort of out there?
I mean, I think this may have been a move to hold off some of the even more extreme measures that House Republicans could take. I don't know. Look, lots of things can happen, but she's an underdog in her primary now. So the notion that Republicans need to do more things to show how, you know, Trumpy they are, it doesn't make a whole lot of political sense. And there's also a question. I mean, McCarthy raised this himself in an interview a few weeks ago. The filing deadline isn't for a little bit in Wyoming. There's an open question on whether she actually ends up running.
Interesting.
And if she sees polling, if Congresswoman Cheney sees polling that continues to look pretty grim, she may end up deciding not to run for reelection and pursuing, you know, other strategies for her political future.
Yeah. Adam Kinzinger has already announced he will not be running for reelection in his district in Illinois. That is a very interesting point, one that I had not considered yet, Josh. Let me finish with this then and sort of go more big picture. The importance right now for Republicans for a Trump endorsement. More important than it was, say, when he was president, less important. How do you play in sort of the endorsements that are now coming from Senate Republican leaders that I'm assuming are going to move in the other direction? You know, what do you make if you're a voter of all of these endorsements?
What's interesting, Jared, is that it's less now about Trump's endorsement. It's more about trying to avoid getting on Trump's bad side. You don't want to be attacked by Trump. You don't mean you may not need his endorsement, though. And if he does endorse someone in a primary for a Senate race or a governor's race.
He's not endorsed, for instance, in the Ohio Republican primary. The first
but let's look at some of the races where he has endorsed. Alabama Senate race, Mo Brooks. Mm-hmm. Mo Brooks is not running away with that primary. It's a three-way race, and it's one where he struggled, the Trump candidate. The Georgia governor's race, Trump has gone all in for David Perdue. He recruited him into the race. He hates Brian Kemp, the governor, and Kemp is now leading by a healthy margin and seems to have the momentum in that campaign. I could go down and down the list of Trump-endorsed candidates. A lot of them are doing very poorly in their respective primaries. So, I mean, his power has waned, but I think what still has a lot of power is if Trump attacks you. If Trump decides that Liz Cheney is unacceptable, then she's going to be in trouble. If he doesn't like, you know, any congressman who voted for impeachment, that's going to be a problem for them. But he's had a lot less success in endorsing and in single-handedly promoting a candidate this cycle as compared to when he was president.
What about the endorsement of Mitch McConnell? Is that going to mean much to voters?
Well, I mean,
we talk about the unusualness of, say, Kevin McCarthy coming out endorsing somebody, because generally, as you point out, that the party leadership tries to stay neutral or at a minimum support the incumbent. Mitch McConnell has talked about, listen, we're going to stay neutral, but if I see something and I see a primary candidate who I don't think can win, I'm going to get involved. I mean, that's not really the role historically of a Republican leader in the Senate, is it?
Well, McConnell has always had his eye on the politics of his conference and the politics of primaries. He's very much attuned to the reality that if you have a bad candidate or a candidate that's too extreme, they can lose in an otherwise good political environment. McConnell's endorsement per se doesn't matter like Trump's does, but his machinations behind the scenes actually may matter more. So when you look at, you know, Josh Hawley endorsing a candidate in Missouri, Congresswoman Hartzler, in that very crowded primary field, because Republicans are worried that the scandalized former governor could win that nomination, that McConnell, I'm sure, has had conversations with other Republicans about that race. He's looking at races where, you know, you don't have a clear candidate, but there may be a bad candidate in the mix that he doesn't want to win the nomination. And there are ways to do things behind the scenes that McConnell is very, very aware of. And I think his allies in Republican politics are doing their best to prevent unelectable candidates from winning some of these primaries.
Well, we got a lot to watch. The first primary is actually already underway in Texas. Election Day, the primary day, March 1st. So that's something that we'll be watching as President Biden delivers his first State of the Union. That'll be a busy night for us. You'll be part of our coverage, part of our broadcast team. So we will talk certainly then and probably before then as well, Josh. I appreciate the time. Have a good weekend.
Looking forward to it, Jared. We'll see you later.
That will do it for this week's Fox News Rundown from Washington. Next week, we'll of course report the latest from Washington and abroad on the situation in Ukraine and the push for a diplomatic resolution. And next week could be the week President Biden names his choice to join the U.S. Supreme Court as he prepares to deliver his first State of the Union address on March 1st. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay in touch with those you care about. For our team here at Fox News Radio, thank you for listening. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.